Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here in KiteLine, we hope to share these messages with you across the prison walls.
This week's episode starts off with news of a strike by prison guards in Alabama. We also have letters and information from prisoners greatly in need of pen pals.
In an interesting turn of events, prisoners at the Holman Prison say they have been joined by an unlikely ally, their own guards. On Saturday, September 24th, officers refused to show up for their evening shifts, citing issues of overcrowding and the need for mass release, more education, and rehabilitation programs, as well as issues with disease and filth. The refusal of guards to work has forced upper-level officials, including the warden, to take over basic tasks like passing out food trays. A prisoner known as Kinetic Justice stated, "I can't believe it. No officers came to work. No more will they be pawns in the game. High time it's going down."
We received a letter from an inmate at the local jail who expressed concern about her treatment in the facility. If you want your story read on the air, you can send mail to our P.O. Box. It's P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. Now here's Caitlin's letter.
To whom it may concern, my name is Caitlin Henderson Essick. I've been incarcerated in Monroe County Jail since June 11th, 2015, on a level 2 dealing in a narcotic. On October 18th, 2016, I will sign a plea bargain of 12 years, do 9 actually. I'm writing you because I'm a married lesbian, and my wife was arrested with me. According to staff's own words, my wife was supposed to be maximum security, and I was supposed to be minimum. However, having already been informed that we were a married couple, the processing officer made us both medium and moved people to another block so that we could be housed in G43 together. After a couple months, we were released to minimum security, and in October we were moved to E block. At first, we were put in available cells. By the end of October, though, we were both in E44. No officer can say they ever saw any physical contact between Henderson, my wife, and I, let alone sexual activity. Another married lesbian couple came to the block and were showering together, so when one of them was transferred, the guards decided to place her in the other female block upon her return. That is when my problems began. They wrote continually complaining about us being housed together, and they weren't. So on March 14th, 2016, Sergeant Wilson came and asked if we were married. We told the truth, and I was informed I would be moving back to G Block. After signing administrative segregation paperwork, I asked for a correspondence request form. Once I submitted the form, I was told I needed to provide a proof of marriage. So why was I moved if they didn't confirm I was married? On June 2nd, 2016, G Block was turned into a male block, leaving E Block as the only female block, except for H, the female trustee block. The other couple had already been released from jail. When the other women in G Block were moved to E Block, I was moved to H Block because Crow refused to rehouse me in a block with my spouse. I constantly wrote Crow and Major Moser from June 2nd, 2016 until July 25th, 2016. Forced manual labor is a violation of my 13th Amendment. I never received a response. Finally, on July 25th, 2016, I told Sergeant Jordan and Captain Hutchins I did not want to be a trustee anymore. They just shrugged me off, so I told them I was serious. I would not work any longer. I was then told to pack my things, and they would be back. At a little past 4 p.m., I was placed in rear detox due to not wanting to work. Mind you, rear detox already had an individual in it. They had to move that mail into soft booking to house me in rear detox. Once again, I had to sign administrative segregation paperwork. I believe it was unnecessary rigor to put me in rear detox versus soft booking. In rear detox, you are not allowed to have anything except your uniform. No mat, no blanket, not even toilet paper or jail-issued shoes. In soft booking, you are allowed to have those things. The male they moved in there was in the turtle suit, so there was no reason to move him except to give harsher treatment to me. Sergeant Dorman put me in a conference room on third shift so that I could have a mat and blanket. At approximately 9:30 a.m., I was told I was being moved to soft booking until the following week when Crow returned. I asked if I just went back to the trustee block if this would all stop. Officer Anthus asked, "Are you going to work?" I responded with, "I don't have a choice, do I?" And he laughed and said he was glad I finally realized that. Officers that I would rather not mention encouraged me to send a stamped envelope to the sheriff about what I'm going through, because in-house mail might get confiscated. On August 4th, Crow finally addressed me and told me I was to remain in H Block. I told him that my wife and I were housed together for 9 months, and I refused to believe that his staff would go against his policy by housing us together. He confirmed that it is not in writing, it is something he's been working on. So I asked him how long he's been working on it, because gay marriage has been legal for a couple years now. I asked him why I could not be locked down in general population. He informed me the only way I would be housed in E Block is if my spouse was not in this facility. What about non-married couples that come in together? They moved a woman from E47 into E51, housing her with a woman she dated in the past. After a short time, they got into it and asked to be moved. Then they moved one into E55 with yet another woman she's had relations with. Officers inform me there is a male non-married couple that was arrested and processed together that is housed in A Block together. So why can Crow discriminate against me for exercising my constitutional right to gay marriage, but he doesn't do anything to anyone else? I have filed grievances trying to get copies of any policy backing up why I was disciplined for not wanting to work and why I'm enduring discrimination due to my sexual preference. I've written the ACLU and the newspaper with no response. Part of me thinks my mail is not reaching its destination. If this is something you could publicize, I would greatly appreciate it. Bloomington Police Department is supposed to be hiring 2 LGBTQ liaisons, but the jail can discriminate against me and violate my rights. I want the situation exposed so that no one else has to go through what I've gone through. Thank you for your time and consideration. Sincerely, Caitlin Henderson, Essex.
We have a list of prisoners who are asking for help. They are hoping to receive letters, as some of them have not had contact with people on the outside for quite a while. We have some messages and information from these prisoners here. For more information, you can also visit needsfriendsnow.blogspot.com. Here's a letter from August 11th, 2016. White, divorced father of one, 55, 6'2", and 280 pounds. I have receding brown and gray hair and blue eyes. I've been confined since 1991 due to 3 separate cases and will be eligible for parole when I'm 219 years of age, which will change if I can get the case I am innocent of overturned. My sense of humor is my coping tool that graces me with a personality that draws other prisoners toward me. For several years, I've written short stories, many poems, and a couple of tunes. My last poem was in 2007. It has been a long, dark, and lonely walk these past 25-plus years, and I'm hoping people would like to be pen pals, assist me in my legal struggle to prove my innocence, do searches for me on the internet, public files, and open records requests. Please no stickers on the envelope or writing paper, and no perfumed letters. The mailroom rejects these letters. Yours, Charles Downing.
We have an older letter from a prisoner who is deaf and going blind. Although the letter is a few years old, records indicate that Tim Crowley is still incarcerated, housed at the Waupun Correctional Facility in Wisconsin. Updated information can be found at needsfriendsnow.blogspot.com. Here are some excerpts from his letter. I'll be brief. I'm hearing impaired and has been all my life, and I'm diagnosed as Usher syndrome, which is in all actuality been part of my life as well, but never knew until 2007. It consists of being hearing impaired and blindness. So I were informed by doctors that I will need to learn Braille and ASL, sign language, if I choose to live in a deaf community. On top of all this, I am also considered mentally ill. Through institutions the majority of my life. Outpatient at the Milwaukee Mental Health Complex at the age of 15 years. I've been part of the system since the age of 11, but in family court since the age of 10. Also, my speech impediment is a burden. I hurt self. I've been incarcerated since the age of 19. I am going on my 16th year. I were shipped out due to unstable behavior that were the result of my little brother being murdered, and he was murdered by someone we know, so you can imagine how that affect me. Well, I've much more to show or tell of my personality dilemma and complexes. Tim Crowley.
Next, we have a letter from Ali Mursal. We are told that Ali Mursal was very withdrawn when he first wrote. He could only write a few words, and they were always the same. He needed love. H would not leave his cell, even when he was in general population. He has grown a lot and now talks freely about his feelings. His brother shed some light on Ali's problems. The family is from Somalia, and when Ali was 7, he saw his father murdered. He was treated very badly also. The family are refugees from that period, and Ali never got the treatment he needed to overcome what he saw and experienced. Following is what he wrote a few years ago. My name is Ali, and I'm from Africa, born and raised. I came to the States to see how it is. Now that I'm in prison, they are trying to send me back to Africa. I nor my family wants that. If you are looking for a good, strong, honest friend, and if you want to know more about me, please write.
For information about these and other prisoners who would like someone to write to them, please visit needsfriendsnow.blogspot.com, which can direct you to updated addresses and other information. You may be familiar with the idea of NIMBY, standing for Not in My Backyard. Well, for this episode of KiteLine, we'd like to focus on some positive local programs for those affected by incarceration. This is our YIMBY episode, Yes in My Backyard. We learn about the Indiana Prisoners Writing Project, speak with volunteers from New Leaf New Life, Pages to Prisoners, and the Indiana Recovery Alliance, which are just a few of the programs we are happy to see in our area.
The Indiana Prisoners Writing Workshop is a mail-in program based in Bloomington, Indiana. Our goal is to help inmates revise their writing, whatever form it may take, poetry, fiction, essays, or the like, so that their voices and stories come across as clearly and compellingly as possible. Your stories matter, and we want to help you craft your words so that more people listen. Our mailing address is the Indiana Prisoners Writing Workshop, CO, Boxcar Books, 408 East 6th Street, Bloomington, Indiana, 47408. That's IPWW, care of Boxcar Books, 408 East 6th Street, Bloomington, Indiana, 47408. If you are a writer or reader in Bloomington and would like to help, we're also open to volunteers who would like to read inmates' work and offer them honest, helpful feedback. To learn more, feel free to write in prisonerswritingworkshop@gmail.com.
I work with New Leaf New Life, which is an organization that was born more than 20 years ago, originally with a group called Citizens for Effective Justice that organized in response to a tasing death in the jail. And today, they're the main point of access to develop programs in the jail. And also in the community, there is a transition support center that directly works to serve folks who are recently incarcerated. So these are both great spots if folks are interested in serving in some capacity directly in the local jail or in the community to support folks who were formerly incarcerated. And I just want to talk a little bit about both of those spaces. So in the jail, New Leaf supports different writing programs. They support addictions recovery. They support games nights. Bingo happens. They have all sorts of different folks who come in and just are present with people and get to spend time sort of running programs. The majority of programs are actually in what's called the Addicts in Recovery Dorm, which is a dorm that's made up of individuals that the state identifies as men. It's a 12-person dorm, and it's the closest to a democratically run space that the jail will allow. People self-select into the dorm, and they are sort of voted out in some ways if something goes wrong, unless some sort of violation to the jail happens, and then they're still removed from the jail or from that space into the other blocks. But they commit to doing programming from noon to five every single day, and they run a lot of their own programming, and they invite folks from the community in to help facilitate different programs. So it's a space that actually gets to see a lot of resources and connections with folks on the outside. In some ways, this is wonderful, but in other ways, I think that it becomes sort of the front or the major space in which folks can serve folks in the jail, and there are only 12 people in that block. I also help facilitate a number of programs for folks the state identifies as women, and I'll talk a little bit about those later. But the Transition Support Center is in the old Mother Hubbard's Cupboard space, 1010 South Walnut, just a little further south down past Shalom. And it's a space that serves community members that lack access to basic supports in our community and really attempts to support people with records as they navigate social inaccess after incarceration. And there are a lot of logistical programs that help support access to housing, healthcare, work, community networks. Our main staff person is someone who is formerly incarcerated and serves sort of in a social work capacity and supporting people in really navigating their basic needs while also recognizing the constraints that people have when they have records. And the Transition Support Center also provides a number of resources, bus passes, hygiene, clothes, rides places, but it's also just a like decent space for people to hang out, which is sorely lacking in Bloomington. We don't have police in that space, and we are willing to take in folks who are even banned from Shalom. And so it's a space to be cool in the summer and get cold water, and a space to be warm in the winter. And we're committed to sort of keeping that be a space that isn't just programs, but is just a space to be, like to exist in the world when you're really not allowed to exist in the world anywhere else. And I think both of these spaces create really fantastic points of access for folks who want to tap in and work with people who are formerly incarcerated or currently incarcerated. And I think that one of the rich things about the organization that runs both the programs in the jail and the community support center is that a lot of folks, even those who are on the board, have really different goals and visions and investments, but there's a ton of flexibility for innovation for individuals who want to work sort of under the umbrella of this organization. I actually first joined up with New Leaf, New Life about 5.5 years ago now, because I was trying to find a way to get into the jail, to bring in university students to study as peers with folks who are incarcerated there, and New Leaf is the only point of access for them. And after teaching a couple classes in the jail that focused really specifically on public speaking and community organizing, really focusing on empowering people to address injustices that they've encountered within our community, I have extended programs that sort of exceed the semesters that I taught within the jail and continue to run think tanks, both with individuals that the state identifies as men and individuals that the state identifies as women in their separate blocks, and a reentry collective, which is hosted at the Transition Support Center and allows people to have sort of consistency of community organizing programming inside and outside of the jail, because once you leave, you're banned and not allowed to continue to organize with folks you are organizing with. And in those spaces, we work really hard to sort of identify some of the social inaccess that people face on a like habitual basis and try to bring it to light. We do a number of sort of community outreaches. People speak at city and county council, they write to the paper, they write safety net, they flyer, they have tried to like do some networking with landlords who might consider renting to folks with records. So we take on a number of projects that really focus on getting people access that they don't have, and having people who have those in accesses be the main faces and voices of that fight, rather than having do-gooders sort of do the good for them, which is, I mean, problematic sometimes. So the other thing that the think tanks really try to do is to let folks identify where they feel like they don't have the resources to do that organizing work, and pull in cool resources from other organizers around the country that help support people feeling the simple confidence to be able to speak publicly, to be able to write into these spaces, to be able to identify and articulate their needs in ways that other people can then hear and come on board with, and to also recognize the resources that they already are and already have in network. So to move away from assuming that because they have records, because they have been poor or had other like inaccesses and bars to education or other resources in their community, that they're somehow unfit to engage in that community space. So I think a lot of the goal is to really have people think about what transformative justice means in terms of pushing on how they themselves have a lot to bring to organizing. And while the think tanks originally started to really keep some of the students from the semester, and it was primarily my students who came from like low-income backgrounds or who had some connection to incarceration in their families already who stayed on. Since then, we've had a number of community members, a lot of whom also have connections to the carceral system or just to like deep poverty, and have seen a lot of the way the state creates certain impossibilities. And so it's become a really brilliant space for folks sort of across the board who are incarcerated and who are not incarcerated to be able to come together and think about what it means to be a community together and how together they face sort of different inaccesses that they can work on creating bridges for together.
The Indiana Recovery Alliance at base is comprised of drug users helping other drug users to mitigate health risks and also to make positive change as those people define positive change. What that means is that it's a collaborative effort rather than forcing abstinence or using coercive measures or having unreasonable expectations on how people are supposed to behave. You ask them what would be positive change in their life, how could they have less chaotic lives if they're even experienced chaos in their lives? So that could be anything from giving someone a clean syringe all the way to a complete abstinence. And we'll celebrate everything in between. If somebody stops using cocaine intravenously and goes to smoking crack, that's a positive change. So we would celebrate that. So the Indiana Recovery Alliance grew out of a need, right, that was self-identified by people and by friends that we knew. Almost everybody involved is either currently or formerly an IV drug user. We believe in direct action. We believe in collaboration. So we just started doing it. I believe that prison abolition is harm reduction, right? Mm-hmm. I believe that meeting people's needs is what is going to lead to people feeling safe, if that makes sense, on both ends. And I believe that that's true whether you're talking about people using drugs or whether you're talking about poverty or whether you're talking about oppressed populations. Mm-hmm. So I think that we fit perfectly into an alternative model, just talking about substance use, an alternative model to a failed war on drugs. So for 100 years since the Harrison Act, we've treated a public health issue as a criminal issue. And this is an opportunity to revert back to treating it as a public health issue. So if we started treating our other social issues as the social issues they are, rather than criminal issues, we could make headway.
If people wanted to get involved, what are the ways that they could help?
Unfortunately, as with other projects, we are severely underfunded. So financial help is very good. They can also come in if they were interested in volunteering and fill out an application, and we go through an interview process, and that's also very helpful. We tend to go with people who are currently or were formerly using IV drugs as our prime candidates for volunteers. Mm-hmm. But we also accept everybody else if they're interested. And all the time, we can use people rounding up blankets and clothes and toiletries and bus passes. Things like those can be gathered and brought to us throughout the year by anyone. At everybody's leisure, it's a pretty easy thing to do. They can find us at IndianaRecoveryAlliance.org. They could find us on Facebook if they put in Indiana Recovery Alliance. There's also an IRA volunteer group on Facebook. And they can call 812-56-SAFER. We don't have to wait for permission to address the needs of our community.
Well, I started with the IRA back in October, and at that point, it was just organizing clothes. We would do outreach, give people who had just come out of jail, they have no resources. We could provide them with clothes, shoes, hook them up with places like New Leaf, New Life. And then once we went through the health department and got everything underway to where this became legal, we had help from the Chicago Recovery Alliance, and that's like our big sister. They've donated so many supplies. They've helped us with grants. I always hate it when people are like, I don't want my tax money going to something like a needle exchange. But the truth is, no one's tax money is going towards this. We get all of our financial stuff from grants. So that's kind of how it started. We have a food truck that has been converted into a nice mobile needle exchange. I would say probably predominantly our clientele tends to be the homeless community. That's just, I would say predominantly, but that's not all of our participants. People always have this idea of what a drug user is. And we had a couple come in that just got married, and outsiders are always looking in like, what do they even talk about? You know, these drug users are horrible people. But, you know, this married couple just came in and they're talking about making like blueberry crisp and recipes just like normal people. And they have dreams, and, you know, and they have jobs. And it's not like this degenerate that's living under a bridge clinging to a bottle. It's not like that. I think this is still pretty new. To me, it's education and making resources available to everyone. And there's also a stigma that, oh, we're going to find needles everywhere in our community, you know, dirty needles on the street. But statistically, what we've seen from our sister programs, that actually decreases. Like in Seattle and Chicago, the way that we discard of the dirties, it's no longer a problem. You might find one or two on the street, but for the most part, like, that's another mission of ours, is to keep it clean and be proactive about that as much as possible. I've heard stories, you know, of people that only had syringes on them and they've been prosecuted, and that's a felony. That follows you for the rest of your life. The prosecutor is supporting our mission, but we still have a disparity between that and what cops know. A cop finds a syringe, he very well could still arrest somebody for that. He could say, well, we know you're a participant of this, but that doesn't matter. You know, you're coming with us. I'm not for sure how to gap that bridge yet between our mission and what the prosecutor is saying is okay, and then what cops are practicing. That's not really surprising.
What are the kind of things that people could do to help?
We are constantly, always in need of socks. Working with a large portion of the homeless community, I've talked to people who are so grateful just to have socks. I've had this same pair on for a year. You know, you hear stuff like that all the time. And I guess, you know, just getting the word out there that, you know, we're here to help people, and it's harm reduction and not spreading disease. Something that I would really like is for people to start coming in and not be afraid anymore, because we are their advocates, you know, and it's a community with honest and genuine concern of being oppressed, because that's all they've known is, you know, people judging them. And we've had people come in here and just start crying because they can't believe that we're so open and that we don't care. Our mission is to love. Even if recovery is not the goal, that's okay. And I think I've mentioned before that everyone here is former or current drug users. I don't know, that's one of my passions, at least, is to fight that stigma and to help people feel okay to be here. And that was our big struggle in the beginning, was people were afraid to come in because, you know, what if I leave and the cops are watching, which is illegal. Cops are not allowed to pull you over if they see you leave here. New people come in all the time and they're like, you know, to be honest, I'm nervous. I can't blame them because of how the general society treats people. It's the lack of education on this society's part, and it's really depressing. I've dealt with addiction and my own family can't even understand, and you know, it's almost like you're treated like a second class citizen. And I think everyone's tired of that and they just want to feel loved, be able to feel safe somewhere. It feels like no good deed goes unpunished. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate. Time after time, these people have been f***ed over. I say these people, but I'm including myself in that as an addict. So I feel like they're justified in those feelings.
I'm Taylor Dean, and a volunteer at the Midwest Pages to Prisoners Project. Pages is a free books to prisoners program. Folks come in and read letters that we receive from people who are locked up in prisons, in jails, and mental health facilities, and in youth detention centers across 9 states, mostly centered in the Midwest. So people come in and read those letters and choose up to 3 books for each person to send from our donated collection of books. There are a lot of different ways that people can get involved. Pages accepts donations of books and packing supplies, postage, blank journals, writing paper, printing paper.
The full interview with Taylor, along with more information about the Midwest Pages to Prisoners Project, can be found in the second episode of our show, which you can find on our website and on iTunes.
This has been KiteLine. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, KiteLine Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. KiteLine wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message or share a story to be played on the air at 812-269-2517. Or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one. You can find previous episodes of KiteLine or more information on our stories at kitelineradio.noblogs.org. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across the prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been KiteLine. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. to hear more stories, news, and insights about Indiana's prison system and its impact on our communities. Thank you for listening.